1995 Science Dancer Prison presents Session Number 330, Not to be Written, The Nature and Effects of the Modern Temple Art as Oral Canon, by Catherine Fike, with comments by Mark Gustafson.
Session Number 330. My name is Jody England. I'll be chairing this session. In the previous session, Blake Osler and Mark Gustafson were introduced and gave their paper and response. In this session, Kathleen Flake will present the paper Not to be Written or Not to be Written, The Nature and Effects of the Mormon Temple Rite as Oral Canon. And Kathleen Flake, as it mentions in the program, has an MA in Liturgical Studies from Catholic University. She's the author of Supping with the Lord, A Liturgical Theological Theology of the LDS Sacrament. And she also mentioned to me that she is headed to the University of Chicago to work on a PhD in the history of Christianity. And she's also an attorney in Washington, D.C., which makes her the third attorney in this two-session discussion to talk about temple rights. So everything should be resolved after this. No more confusion, right? She is also the temple prep teacher in her Capitol Hill branch, and she told me that she doesn't talk about any of these things in her temple prep class. And someone else who knows her says that she loves female jazz singers and that she would make a wonderful bishop. So we will hear from Kathleen Flake first.
The reason I don't say any of these things in my temple preparation class is they aren't very important to preparing for the temple. So, also, with three lawyers talking to you about the temple, you should have your collective hands and your collective wallet, spiritual wallet here. But I do find it ironic that part of the thesis of this paper is that the very thing that lawyers are trained in is the very way it almost ensures that we will misunderstand what the temple is about. So here we are struggling to talk about it. I guess that proves my thesis. By letter of June 1842, Heber C. Kimball writes to fellow apostle Parley P. Pratt, "I wish you was here so as to feel and hear for yourself. We have received some precious things through the prophet that would cause your soul to rejoice. I cannot give them to you on paper, for they are not to be written." End of quote. In the ensuing 150 years, the Church has not wavered from its earliest insistence that the temple ceremony is not to be written, but only to be experienced by the faithful who feel and hear for themselves by participating in it. If accused of conducting secret rites, the Church will protest that its temple ceremony is sacred, not secret. Believing the indictment of Israel, quote, "They have put no difference between the holy and profane, neither have they showed difference between the clean and the unclean," we have placed our core belief within the temple's ritual setting and strictly limited access to it. Not all within the temple are admitted, and for those who are, even general discussion about the ceremony outside of the temple proper is discouraged. We are admonished, quote, "That which cometh from above is sacred and must be spoken of with care and by constraint of the Spirit." It seems then obvious that the content of the temple ceremony is both sacred and secret. Sacred to the initiated in that it is set apart by the way it is treated with respect to their other knowledge, and secreted from the uninitiated in that they are not to know it at all. This paper does not dispute either of these views of the temple ceremony. Rather, it seeks an understanding of what purposes are served by the sacred secretness or secret sacredness of the temple. My emphasis is, therefore, on the process by which the temple ceremony is maintained, not its content. I respect the prescriptions placed on those of us who have received these ordinances. Indeed, what I have learned about oral traditions makes me even more respectful of the methods by which we maintain these, quote, precious things from the prophet. Thus, putting aside for the moment the more mystical truths about how God works in the world, and of course you appreciate the absurdity of that when talking about the temple, it's like saying putting aside wetness when you talk about water, but that's what I'm going to do today. And I will suggest that many of the important effects of the LDS temple rite are facilitated by its being maintained as if it were an oral tradition. As you know, the ceremony was not written down until 35 years after its first enactment in 1842. That in and of itself is worthy of note, given what a record-keeping fetish we have as a people. But now that it is written down, some of you may question whether I can properly consider it an oral tradition. By the narrowest of definitions, I suppose it could not be considered an oral phenomenon, but even a cursory review of the techniques employed for conveying the rite quickly demonstrates that we strategically use the convention of an oral tradition in how we learn and teach and maintain this ordinance among us. No text is read during the temple ceremony. It is performed from memory, both by those who lead the rite and those who participate in it. The vast majority of participants never see any portion of the ceremony reduced to writing. Indeed, it is not generally acknowledged that a script even exists. Such authorized written accounts of the ceremony as exist are rare and made available only to temple workers for the narrow purpose of learning their parts. Even here, however, only that portion of the text relevant to the temple worker's role is available within a discrete part of the temple, reserved for such purposes, and that portion of the text may not be taken outside of the temple. Hence, such text as exists is made available in part and for the sole purpose of committing it to memory for performance within the temple. Of course, beginning in 1842 and continuing to the present, there have been numerous unauthorized versions of the temple ceremony published in a variety of media by those who no longer affiliate with the church or who believe that Mormonism poses a cultic threat to traditional Christian faith. Viewed as products of, quote, apostates who seek to injure or destroy the church, usually distorted, end of quote, these texts are ignored by the church. The faithful are strongly discouraged from reading or speaking about the rite. And with extraordinarily few exceptions, we do not. The few books published by the church on this subject are devoted to analyses of the role of temple ordinances in the plan of salvation, or to oblique analogizing of LDS temple practices to those of ancient civilizations, as you heard today. In sum, we treat our temple ceremony in a manner most analogous to an oral tradition, and in practical effect, it operates as such among us. Though a text exists, it is not generally known to exist, and is not employed during the rites. Neither the text nor its performance are commented on in writing, and both are subject to discussion only in the most oblique terms. Finally, no text is available to the participants except under discrete circumstances, and even then, not in its entirety, and for only the amount of time required to memorize it. Thus, while the ritual may not be obtained licitly in writing by the uninitiated, neither can it be obtained in writing by the initiated. The price of access to the rite and its specific contents is the same for all. Participation in the social body, which is created by the ritual, and creative of the ritual as it is handed down personally, even orally, from generation to generation. I believe there are at least two reasons for the church's employing the conventions of an oral tradition within its modern literate community. First, doing so protects the temple's legitimacy as a source of immutable truth, notwithstanding the rite's periodic mutation. Secondly, employing the conventions of an oral tradition maximizes the temple ritual's capacity to negotiate meaning of the ceremony without fragmenting the community ordered by it. Each of these points will now be considered in turn. The surest way to fix a notion, to obtain maximum uniformity of expression and dictate meaning, is to record it and read it. In writing, consciousness is, quote, deemed liberated from the tyranny of the present, it's made permanent. Unfortunately for cosmologies, and that's what our temple is, it's a cosmology, it's the story of the universe, consciousness then becomes subject to the tyranny of the past, because writing also, quote, favors an awareness of inconsistency. It is the nature of language to make distinctions, and it is the consequence of writing to preserve those distinctions. Hence, we have the academic field of the history of ideas, which explores the many ways we have changed our minds about what is true. Many written tomes are strewn in this field. We now only know we have disagreed, but we will never fully forget that sometimes we have been very wrong about what is right. So we not only know we have disagreed, is what I should say there, we not only know we have disagreed over time about a number of very important things, and we can't ever fully forget that sometimes we've been very wrong about what is right. The earth is not flat, kings do not have a divine right to rule, and racial differences are not genetic, much less moral inferiorities. Out of this written record of the conflict between ideas comes our present understanding, but we can never forget it is now our history, It is memorialized in black and white print that once we didn't think as we do now about many things. We expect the same will be true of the future. Our age is characterized by the fragmentation of belief and the admission of the pervasiveness of subjectivity. As concluded by anthropologist Jack Goody, literate societies cannot discard, absorb, or transmute the past. Their members are faced with permanently recorded versions of the past and its beliefs. And because the past is thus set apart from the present, historical inquiry becomes possible. This in turn encourages skepticism. And skepticism not only about the legendary past, but about received ideas about the universe as a whole. From here, the next step is to see how to build up and to test alternative explanations, end of quote. Of course, ritual cosmologies, like the LDS temple ceremony, seek the reverse effect, the unquestioning sense of a received universe as a whole. They resist writing's invitation to find in private thought what we are doing here today. Not communal experience, what they're doing right now in Temple Square, the means of discerning truth. The ritualized communal experience of the temple ceremony, not private thought, is the privileged source of LDS truth. Consequently, the ceremony is carefully protected from historical inquiry, and even an awareness of its having a secular history. The temple is, says one writer, quote, relevant to the eternities. The modern world is as unstable as a decaying isotope, but the temple has always been the same. The ordinances are those taught by an angel to Adam, end of quote. By scrupulously maintaining the ritual within an oral tradition, not making its text available or otherwise discussing it publicly for others to record authoritatively its specific contents, the church enables the temple ceremony to, quote, I'm quoting here from another anthropologist, the church enables the temple ceremony to, quote, function as a series of interlocking face-to-face conversations in which the very conditions of transmission operate to favor consistency between past and present, and to make criticism, which is the articulation of inconsistency, less likely to occur. And if it does, the inconsistency makes a less permanent impact and is more easily adjusted or forgotten. Now, these are the sine qua non characteristics of an oral tradition. It facilitates a kind of forgetting and a transmuting of inconsistency. And it operates in most oral traditions in an overt and public level. And that is true about our community as well. We know our temple ceremony has changed, but we believe it has not in a particular way. These parts of the temple canon which are deemed to be no longer be relevant or necessary are discarded or transformed without a whisper of announcement, said one newspaper. News of change and its explanation comes from newspapers, not church administration. As reported in the New York Times a couple of years ago, quote, while a spokesman for the church described the church's basic beliefs and obligations as, quote, timeless and binding, she said, quote, the ceremony itself needs to meet the needs of the people, end of quote. The revised ritual is, quote, more in keeping with the sensitivities we have as a society, she added. Notwithstanding such acknowledgments to the community outside of the church, no official comment is made to the church community itself. No doctrinal foundation for, much less commentary on, the, quote, sensitivities which inspired the changes is supplied. No theologizing on the implications of the changes is offered or invited. Indeed, the changes themselves are not even identified except as they are privately experienced by the participants in the course of performing the ritual who see and know for themselves. And with each performance, the conventional forms of the ritual, formality, stereotypy, condensation, and redundancy, restore the sense of the ritual's timelessness and immutability. Personal knowledge and experience of change is neither remarked upon nor long remembered, and the sense of collective shared experience in one eternal round of ordered life is retained. Thus, notwithstanding changes to the rite since its inception and increasing publicity about modern adaptations, the perception of the faithful remains that the temple rite and its canon are today as they were first revealed to Joseph Smith. For example, one LDS historian has referred to, quote, the formidable task of describing and explaining what happened on the 4th of May, 1842, the day our temple ceremony was first administered as given in our temples today, end of quote. Now,
your hackles should be rising a little bit as I describe this, because by virtue of your being here, I think you favor another kind of learning than the one I've just described. So approaching this phenomenon of an oral tradition with the assumptions of a textually literate and ritually illiterate society, and both of those things are important phenomenon, both our textual literacy and our ritual illiteracy on a conscious level, it is possible for us to conclude that our use of the oral conventions to adapt and forget is at best secrecy in service of willful ignorance, or at worst deceit in the service of social control. To do so, however, ignores that, quote, and this is, I'm quoting from a ritual theorist here, the issue of truthfulness as a matter of conforming to what exactly happened at some point in the past is probably not the issue that is most important for an oral community, end of quote. If asked, the vast majority of temple-going Latter-day Saints, and certainly the academics referenced throughout this paper, will acknowledge that the temple rite has changed over time, even recently. They will, however, in the same breath, protest the relevancy of change to their present experience of the transcendent through the medium of temple ritual. Thus, the LDS historian who assumed, quote, the formidable task of describing the original enactment of the rite ultimately resorts in his paper to discussing instead the meaning of the temple to the faithful. He says, quote, in temples we have a staged representation of the step-by-step ascent into the presence of the eternal while we are yet alive, end of quote. This is, of course, ultimately what religion aspires to provide. Of course, this is what religion aspires to provide. So it is certainly not the most important issue for Latter-day Saints acting here as an oral community to describe what actually happened at some point in time in the past. After all, as one scholar observed, religion is not a cognitive system, a set of dogmas alone. It is meaningful experience and experienced meaning. This is what Latter-day Saints seek in their temples, an attempt by means of oral traditioning to shelter from discursive thought and public debate. A primary benefit of doing so is illustrated by James Smart's expression of ambivalence about the success of biblical criticism on scriptural canons. Here is what one biblical critic observes about his own discipline. He says, one cannot help welcoming the excavation of every fresh feature of the human story, but at the same time, one must recognize the distortion that is taking place with the elimination of the participation and action of the living God from the story. That elimination of a living God from the biblical history can so easily be also the elimination of a living God from our present history. That, in fact, was the disastrous influence upon the faith of Christians of a historicist biblical science that, in clearing away the mythological language of the biblical witnesses, reduced their living God, whose powerful presence they knew, to a religious concept or ideal, end of quote. Orally traditioning LDS belief within the temple's ritual setting is a means of attempting, I believe, to prevent in a modern literate community, quote, the elimination of a living God from our own present history, end of quote, by remaining aloof from the, quote, excavation of every fresh feature of the human story, end of quote. The Church's refusal to textualize its ritualized canon and submit it to the literacy of even the faithful sets the rite apart, secretes it from discursive thought and attendant public debate. In this way, orally traditioning the rite maximizes the muteness that is inherent in ritual. Catherine Bell writes, ritualization is embedded within the dynamics of the body, defined within a symbolically structured environment. An important corollary to this is the fact that ritualization is a particularly mute form of activity. It is designed to do what it does without bringing what it is doing across the threshold of discourse or systematic thinking. End of quote. Hence, the conventions of both ritual and oral traditioning contribute materially to the maintenance of the canonicity of the LDS temple rite. They prevent fragmentation of understanding and belief, what Goody describes as the skepticism which follows from criticism, the articulation of inconsistency. They also protect religious experience of the divine from what Stewart identifies as criticism's conceptual reductionism. In sum, both orally traditioning and ritually embodying our core doctrine in the temple immunizes it from a sense of history, giving it unique authority and legitimacy in our present lives. There is, however, a second effect, of maintaining the temple ceremony as an oral tradition. And it is primary to the integrity of the LDS community, not just our doctrine. The strategic use of the conventions of oral tradition to sustain the sense of ordered wholeness in our conceptual beliefs is ultimately protective also of our sense of who we are and how we relate as community. In short, it enables meaningful experience not only with the living God, but also with each other. It is a given that whatever else rituals are, they are social undertakings both expressing and creating relationships. For example, though it is the passage aspects of the rites of passage that seems to capture most attention on the subject, the passage only exists for the ultimate purpose of putting the initiate in right relationship to the ritual community. The sense of community generated by the temple ceremony is enhanced by the way in which oral traditioning of the temple rite structures the relationships within that ritual community itself. None are set apart to interpret the rite, and don't underestimate the importance of that and the freedom it gives us. None are set apart to interpret the rite. All are under the same requirement to maintain it as an oral tradition. During the ritual, all present are enacting the ritual, and all are eligible to officiate in those parts that require it. The rite is devoid of reference to ecclesiastical position and title. The ritual is always transmitted within the temple proper by a person who knows the ritual to one who does not. The one mentors the other by teaching questions and giving answers. It is an immediate exchange between ritually identified persons, not between persons and textualized ideas. It is not what we're doing right now. It is something very different. What Jack Goody said of the Socratic method could also be said of the temple. It is, quote, a social process in which initiates pass on their knowledge directly to the young, a process indeed in which only a long personal relationship can transcend the inherent incapacity of mere words to convey ultimate truths, the forms or ideas of which alone can give unity and coherence to human knowledge, end of quote. The solidarity of the LDS community, its sense of ordered wholeness on a social, not only a conceptual level, is enhanced by the oral traditioning of our temple rite. On the whole, writes Jack Goody, there is less individualization of personal experience in oral cultures, which tend to be characterized by ties between persons rather than between individuals in a variety of roles. In this manner, the strategic use of oral conventions within the modern literate LDS church is basic not only to our cosmos building, but also our Zion building intentions. In our zeal to build Zion, the saints have always manifest separatist tendencies, not the least of which was our westward trek beyond the borders of the United States to this place in the Great Salt Lake Basin. There the early saints hoped, in Arrington and Benton's words, to put behind them the misunderstanding, dissension, persecution, and temptation of contemporary American society, and to build a new and better civilization in the Zion of their mountain stronghold, end of quote. Today, the mountains have long ceased to be a stronghold for us. The rise of the global village, as well as our own proselytizing intentions and temporal prosperity, make it impossible for us to find our communal identity in economic, political, or geographic separatism as we once did. It is the final hypothesis of this paper that the church's oral traditioning of the temple ceremony is today no less creative of our identity than these other more obvious strategies once were. More subtle than LDS economic utopianism and social engineering, both the ritualization and the oral traditioning of the church's core belief make of the temple a unique source of self-identification and cohesion in a rapidly growing and increasingly diverse population. Hence the renewed emphasis on the temple by today's leadership, who have denominated the possession of a temple recommend the great symbol of our membership. The temple solidifies through the conventions of ritual and oral traditioning the LDS faith community. It defines the community's internal cohesiveness and external boundaries in terms of cosmically defined, historically impervious beliefs assumed by covenant. No longer able or desiring to isolate ourselves in the Rocky Mountain West or to particularize ourselves by separate commercial or marital economies, I believe we will increasingly rely upon the temple for our sense of separateness, which is also our sense of cosmic wholeness and solidarity as a community. Such solidarity does not, however, mean that the community is immune to change. Neither is it wise to conclude that the church's strategies for creating doctrinal and communal solidarity merely stave off change. And this is too easy a conclusion for textually dependent people or intellectuals to make. We tend to think ritual is a controlling mechanism. Rather, as now will be discussed, the oral and ritual strategies which engender the faithful sense of conceptual and communal unity are paradoxically, I believe, the same conventions which facilitate change in belief and community. They allow us to adapt our temporal reality without requiring us to abandon our sense of relational and ideological wholeness. Only one example can be given here. If, as one person wrote, complex ritual ossifies when it does not speak to the minds and hearts of succeeding generations facing change and upheaval, it is not surprising that, as reported in a newspaper recently, quote, the Mormon Church has changed some of its most sacred rituals, eliminating parts viewed as offensive to women, end of quote. Gender roles are at the heart of the LDS temple rite, and no aspect of life in this generation of the Church has been as subject to change and upheaval as gender identity. Hence, the Church's most recent adaptations of the temple ceremony illustrate that ritualizing and orally traditioning the LDS temple canon or belief facilitates not only the ordering, but also the peaceful reordering of the LDS community. Few notions are as critical to LDS self-definition as that of the relationship between men and women, most often expressed in our beliefs about the family. Consequently, as one might expect, the community ordered by the temple ritual is rudimentally, this paper is really meant to be read in a journal article to be published, and I feel apologetic to you. There are quotes scattered here and there from a particular field of study, but ritual structures in very rudimentary ways societies. And what I'm trying to say here is that one of the things, if not the most fundamental, most rudimentary structuring that goes on in the temple has to do with gender, which I think is one of the reasons why women struggle with the temple so much, notwithstanding the fact that in the Doctrine and Covenants, the temple is referred to as the House of the Daughters of Zion. But the particular value-laden distinction, another piece of intellectual theory, that we are engaged in the temple has to do with gender. When entering the temple, all participants remove their street clothing, including jewelry and every other insignia of social economic status. And according to the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, I'm quoting here, wear white temple robes symbolizing purity and equality of all persons before God the Father and His Son, Jesus Christ, end of quote. No titles are employed other than brother or sister. Temple worship is conducted in groups called sessions, which begin at set times. Anonymous, all of this goes to the anonymity of these sessions, with multiple identical sessions held daily. Consequently, the group gathered in one session is indistinguishable from those in another, except by the time of day the participants arrive. In fact, the only distinctions made in the temple rite are those based on gender. Some of these distinctions are practical, as in the separation of dressing rooms within the temple. Others have to do with the marking of ritual space, such as the seating in the temple sessions by gender, not by familial relationships or personal status. Ritual identity, such as differences in temple clothing and ritual action. The majority of the ordinances are administered by women to women and by men to men. In this manner, the LDS temple ritual suspends all distinctions except the one which it seeks to ritualize, namely gender. Such value-laden gender distinctions, like those of all other churches, are a source of contention within our church. When these struggles are conducted in the discursive mode, like Sunstone, they appear to be a primary motivation for ecclesiastical discipline, including excommunication. Ecclesiastical authority has classified feminist critique as a particular threat to the church. In an unpublished speech given to the LDS All-Church Coordinating Council in 1993, one of the most senior members of the church hierarchy has cautioned middle management against, quote, the dangers that have made major invasions into the membership of the church, the feminist movement, and the ever-present challenge from the so-called scholars or intellectuals, end of quote. Understood in the light of the theory discussed in this paper, this is not an unexpected or illogical response by church authority. To speak of changes made in belief and practice, to publicly debate them, to write them down and create a history of disparate definitions of, for instance, LDS priesthood and its operations with respect to women can indeed engender skepticism. Because discursive and literate forms directly challenge belief, the LDS Church will not, and we could say in light of these theories, cannot employ these means to experiment with and respond to modern sensibilities without jeopardizing its sense of a shared universe as a whole, immune to human history. Though the church must evolve or become irrelevant, I believe it will likely do so through that method which is designed to do what it does without bringing what it is doing across the threshold of discourse or systematic thinking. It will rely on the conventions of ritual to adapt its core canon. The theoretical basis for this conclusion lies in Catherine Bell's work on ritual theory, ritual practice, where she reasons that ritual is, quote, the mute interplay of complex strategies within a field structured by engagements of power, end of quote. Because it engages minds and bodies in a set of tensions that involve both the domination and resistance, ritual is constitutive of the person so engaged. Ritual is a negotiation, in other words. Okay, it's not just a mechanical imposition of forms upon people, but people are negotiating in communities power and belief, understanding, and roles in ritual in a way they cannot do in debate. So because participants are free to act and understand differently, they make choices determining the extent of their acceptance of the ritual order. This is augmented, of course, by the fact that all of ritual employs symbol, and symbol, by definition, partakes of multiple meanings. When we look at symbols, we can each walk away with disparate definitions, though they're ordered on a certain fundamental cohesiveness if the symbol is working. We can look at a crucifix as Christians and all understand its reference, but if you were to ask each of us as Christians what that crucifix means, I would say something different than my Catholic colleagues. But there is, we are negotiating a belief in a sense. Well, we are symbolically engaging in different definitions as we look at the symbol. When we perform these symbols in ritual, embody these symbols and act them out in rituals, we are actually negotiating the meanings of those symbols. This makes ritual not only a structured but a structuring environment. Quoting again from Catherine Bell, the person who has prayed to his or her God, appropriating the social schemes of the hegemonic order, and that's the political order, in terms of an individual redemption, may be stronger because those acts are the very definitions of power, personhood, and the capacity to act. I'm going to read that again. The person who has prayed to his or her God, this ritual action of praying, appropriating the social schemes of the hegemonic order, in terms of an individual redemption, the person comes to the collective action of the prayerful worship as an individual and appropriates those symbols, may be stronger because these acts are the very definitions of power, personhood, and the capacity to act within that community. End of quote. Thus, for example, the woman who in the LDS temple prays to her God, by that I mean bodily officiates in administering rites of sanctifying significance, takes upon herself the symbols of immortality, and receives her husband by covenant and gives herself to him by the same covenant, is, according to Bell, not merely performing meaning, not merely displaying a fact, not merely performing meaning, but obtaining a practical knowledge, even a mastery that experiences itself as relatively empowered, not as conditioned and molded. Of course, bringing with them, as they do, contemporary sensibilities, this generation of LDS temple goers are affected by receiving or observing a woman's cultic activity within the temple. Neither she nor they are required to believe or disbelieve in ideology. No one says, "Do you agree?" when you go in there. Neither she nor they are required to believe or disbelieve in ideology, a particular assertion, but only to consent to a version of dominant values which they negotiate as they embody the ritual and choose among symbolic multivalence. Okay? Neither she nor they are required to believe or disbelieve an assertion of principle, but only to consent to a version of the dominant values which they negotiate as they embody the ritual and choose among symbolic multivalence, are many meanings. The negotiation is mute, it's quiet, it doesn't speak because it operates below the level of discourse, which permits her and them to, quote, misrecognize both the source of the schemes and the changes these schemes undergo in the temporal process of projection and embodiment. It has even been argued that cosmological rituals in particular are designed to invite these changes. In addition, the strategic oral traditioning of the LDS temple rite maximizes ritual's mute interplay and openness to new contents by enabling the entire community to misrecognize change for stasis and to peacefully reorder itself. The easy forgetting and transmuting of meaning, which characterizes oral traditions, operates so as to, quote, not lead to deliberate rejection and reinterpretation of social dogma so much as to semiotic readjustment of belief. Discursive thought, either written or spoken, which aspires to clarify ambiguity by identifying distinctions, requires deliberate rejection of old belief, the consciousness of choosing among historically sensitive alternatives. Not all in the community will make the same choice and may base a given choice on reasons incidental to a meaningful experience with the living God. Moreover, having once deliberated, others will continue to choose to make distinctions that separate not only the ideas, but also the believers from one another as they debate their differences. In short, because they do not allow a community to make semi-automatic readjustment to change, written words and their critique do not have the power to heal what they have breached. To transmute without comment what is transmitted and misrecognize while negotiating new belief and new community. Orally traditioned ritual enables communities to live with ambiguity and to misrecognize change for stasis, even to believe that the modern world is as unstable as a decaying isotope, but that the temple has always been the same. It is in this paradoxical capacity to mutate what it establishes as immutable that the particular social genius of the LDS temple rite is revealed. Quoting here from another study or ritual, it is the work of ritual action to join again into a whole, again and again, what is in fragile relationship and always in danger of disintegration, namely the future, the present, and the past of a people. End of quote. Thus, while ritual produces power relationships, they are in a constant flux of negotiation. Or as summarily stated by one sister to a newspaper reporter who asked her about gender issues in the temple, she said, quote, like any other ritual, you make it your own, she said. The opportunity provided by the temple ceremony to make meaning one's own, or in other words, to negotiate the meanings of gender in the rite, I believe makes the temple a likely forum for mutely working out the relation between men and women that is so fundamental to LDS doctrine and community. As in the past, we can be expected in the present also to reorder ourselves by means of the ritualized and orally traditioned temple canon. Choosing this means will enable us as a church community to adjust old belief in light of new belief without having to experience ideological contradiction and conflict and the communal conflict which it engenders, though no doubt too slow a process for some. It will nonetheless preserve for most the sense of ordered wholeness so fundamental to who we are as a people and what we believe. It is the figurative and literal muteness of the LDS oral and ritual tradition that has the potential to preserve the religious community it is also changing. In sum, the classic gifts of ritual, which are order, community, and transformation, are strategically augmented by oral tradition to provide in the LDS temple canon a way of coming to rest at the heart of cosmic change and order. Thank you.
You are truly all at risk because the three of us are attorneys here today. I urge you to watch your souls as you leave. I'd like to turn my attention to Kathleen's very absorbing discussion of what reasons might underlie Mormonism's insistence on keeping private and sacred the temple ceremony. In her presentation, she makes some very fascinating observations about the reasons that might support the LDS Church's insistence that the temple ceremony was not to be written, which she correctly points out has a clear effect of separating the initiated Mormon from both the uninitiated Mormon and the general public as well. Though Kathleen observes that the cost of the faith is found in what she supposes to be a general public suspicion about the church, and because of the discipline meted out to those who violate their solemn promise not to reveal the ceremony, I doubt that either event causes much consternation among the Mormon hierarchy. After all, knowledge of the ceremony is only conditionally confidential. Literally, any qualified individual is afforded full access to that information. And I might add at that point, if you have a long history of going to the temple, any changes indicated there are also clearly obvious too. That the general and often profane public is denied immediate access to the ceremony may have no consequence other than the fact that Montel Williams and Jenny Jones will not feature on next Monday's shows. Moreover, if some initiates decide in contravention to their solemn promise to discuss the sacred and profane settings and subsequently get called in to answer for their actions, it is not clear that the inevitable negative coverage in predictable sources like the Salt Lake Tribune and the Los Angeles Times outweighs the importance of preserving the point that promise-keeping ought to be strictly observed, especially in the absence of a morally compelling reason to reveal the ceremony. That decent, faithful members of the LDS Church are wrongly considered at times because of their actions in the same league as Ed Decker is an unfortunate but perhaps an unavoidable result. With that in mind, what do we make of Kathleen's observations that not only is the LDS temple ceremony canon, but that also it is made confidentially for the reason that the absence of a public text permits the church to amend the ceremony when it pleases, for good reason, without much public or any public commentary? She is probably correct when she postulates that the ceremony is central to Mormon theology. Certainly, Mormons believe that only through that experience can the initiated believer be afforded the most complete interaction with God, with an understanding of God. But to suppose, as I think she does occasionally, that the dearth of a printed text isolates the content of the ceremony from analysis or thoughtful consideration might work as an argument with the pre-literate society, but may have little effect and hardly applies to the relatively sophisticated Mormon audience. At the same time, Kathleen makes a more interesting point when she surmises that the ceremony is kept private because by doing so, the legitimacy of the canon and the integrity of the community that it, quote, orders and reorders, close quote, is preserved. Standing as an independent source of God's word, as our author correctly suggests, the ceremony does have a unique place in Mormonism. Having said that, however, surely the Mormon ceremony is kept private for reasons other than avoiding the feared criticism that may be modified from time to time. The reason for withholding from public the printed text must have more to do with preserving the distinctive setting and unified presentation of core Mormon perspectives, which are available only to those individuals who, in the judgment of the Church, best approximate the standards of belief and personal deportment required of mortals by God. I think a strong argument can be advanced that keeping the ceremony private is crucial for reasons other than avoiding the feared objection that the content of the ceremony or its method of presentation may be modified from time to time. After all, to a church membership weaned on the liberating notion that revelation is ongoing for the reason that God interacts with his children, amending the methods of the LDS temple presentation, but not its essence, does not produce the same kind of ecclesiastical heartburn that faithful Catholics must have experienced, for instance, in pre-Vatican II days if someone had advocated the abandonment of High Latin in Mass. Kathleen makes something of the fact that changes have occurred in the temple ceremony since it was instituted. In fact, she claims that there is something disconcerting occasionally about changes in the canon, unaccompanied by even a whisper of public announcement. There is no showing, however, of how the lack of public debate is a significant public or ecclesiastical matter. The lack of open debate may prevent discursive debate, as she correctly points out, to the extent that such discussion has importance. But Kathleen has not demonstrated how that is a significant matter. I hope we are not to the point where only public examination satisfies the test of meaningfulness. Moreover, that anyone attending the temple has noticed the changes in the ceremony seems to satisfy her concern about the literal quality of the ceremony. Regarding the question of the consent to the content of the methods of presenting the ceremony, surely consent is found in the second time one attends. Consent may be vitiated the first time because one is, for reasons that she correctly points out today, not made available prior to attending for the first time. But surely, at that point, one gives constructive consent to any subsequent attendance at a temple ceremony. Having said all of this, though, Kathleen is certainly correct when she points out that the oral tradition of the LDS temple ceremony occupies a unique place in Mormonism precisely because it is insulated from public discourse and examination. It is the unique status and isolated quality of that practice that probably cements its importance to the LDS community. It is a retreat from the world, a setting in which the actions of God towards children are demonstrated. Perhaps that is the final reason for the nature of the ceremony. Matters of intimate faith don't fare well in a disbelieving world. Thank you.
We now have some time for question and answer discussion. I ask that after you phrase the question as simply as you can, I will repeat it, and then whoever it is directed to can answer in through the mic at the table. Questions? Yes. The question concerns the change since, I think it's been 5 years. There were changes in the endowment ceremony, and there seems to be a difference in how much of the ceremony can be talked about outside of the temple, whereas before it seemed that only small parts of it required oaths not to speak of, and since the changes, there seems to be an emphasis that none of it be discussed outside of the temple. And this is directed to both of you.
My understanding is why the brethren would take such a position to change what apparently was a standing practice that only the covenants that you take themselves, that you covenant to maintain secret, would be expanded to include the entire ceremony. Gene, I've actually had the opportunity to discuss this very issue with a number of general authorities directly. I'm not going to give names because of confidences and so forth. I think I need to respect those, but these are the reasons, as I understand them. First of all, drawing a line is not easy. The entire ceremony in and of itself is sacred, and they felt that the ceremony in and of itself was being profaned and misunderstood, and they desired to, at least to those persons who were participating in the ceremony, I think that Kathleen has articulated well what some of their sensibilities are, that when we make it a matter of public discourse, when it becomes a matter of analysis, that we lose a good deal of the spiritual power. They've never been under the impression that somebody was going to be scandalized if they found out that something in the ceremony were less than historically accurate. When you put Adam and Eve together with people from the first century of the Christian era and have them talk to one another, nobody's going to be mistaking this as actual history. And so changes, they've never really worried about changes, because the ceremony has always been something that was malleable and dynamic to express the truths that it was intended to express. It used to be fairly common practice, and this is a particular question that I asked, that temple presidents and others in the temple would meet with groups and try to discuss and explain to them the temple ceremony, and they've stopped that practice by and large. And the reason that they did that is that they wanted it to remain an individual experience and an understanding and interpretation. As one explained it to me, the temple ceremony is par excellence the arena in which those who have eyes to see and ears to hear will see and hear, and those who don't will not. And we don't need somebody trying to force food into the mouths of those who already have quite enough to choke on. That's a paraphrase, but it's as close as I can remember. And I thought that that was quite accurate. Have they gone overboard in understanding what people have agreed to maintain a secret? Probably so. If one, being an attorney and looking at contracts, I tend to look at them and say, what is it that a person's agreed to and that they've undertaken by some kind of contractual covenant or obligation to do? And as I understand the covenants that I take in the temple, the sanction on secrecy isn't nearly as broad as the brethren are now interpreting it. However, given my sensibilities of what is sacred and setting apart what is sacred from what is profane, I'm very reluctant to discuss any aspect. I'm much more open with those who have had the experience and who are, in my view, spiritually able to have those kinds of discussion. I'm much more guarded. I'm extremely uncomfortable discussing any aspect of the temple with somebody whose intent is to make fun of, profane, do an expose. And so I find myself choosing an audience by the very nature of the question. And I think it must be necessarily self-selecting. That's my understanding in my view.
I wouldn't presume to even guess at motives, people who are so remote from myself, but it's consistent with my... I'm middle-aged now, so I too can reflect back on the church like she can. It's consistent with my experience that the church is concerned about orthodoxy in a particular way that it wasn't in my youth. And I can understand that things are a little less in control than they were in my youth. I mean, we don't... I just see this as part of the larger concern about orthodoxy. I think the temple is a pretty uncontrollable thing as a ritual. It's not meant to be controllable. And so I think one of the best ways to do that is just say, don't talk about it. I'm a little more cynical, and I think that we go very far with this rule. We don't even talk about what the temple means. I think that's largely because, this is my cynic, I think too many of us don't know. And it's easier to say, oh, I'm not supposed to say, than to say, I don't know. And so we continue, increasingly I hear us talking to each other about moral tales and a kind of basic religious principle that really the temple doesn't have much to do with. So I think that those, in my own experience, that's where I find it consistent. But I don't know what the brethren are thinking. I think probably Blake has a much better fix on that, and he makes sense in what he says to me.
Yes.
I think Blake wants to respond. He just took the mic.
Blake?
could you kind of re-paraphrase the question you're responding to?
My understanding of the concern is that by maintaining this as an oral tradition and not discussing it and leaving it apart from analysis, we're somehow returning to a pre-literate society, which is something less desirable than a literate society. Is that a fair statement? Oh, okay.
I mean, that, well, of course, the best way to relate to God is in this point. We're already, all of us are not.
We're already literate, yeah. I think that there are literary and discursive ways of approaching truth, but there are also different ways of approaching reality. I think that our society has largely forgotten something that's very valuable that earlier societies knew how to do, and that is to experience symbolically what reality is. We've almost forgotten, I mean, in fact, Alan, you're aware, did an early paper on where have all the all-seeing eyes gone? Where have our symbols gone? They've largely become irrelevant for us. I used to assume that in Catholicism and in earlier religions they used symbols a lot because people were illiterate and this was the best way to teach them because they were stupider than the priests who had studied for years. I've now come to the conclusion that there are different ways of experiencing. When people experience symbols, brain studies demonstrate that it's largely a right hemisphere phenomenon, very immediate, and has a very immediate emotional impact. Whereas if you filter it through kind of a discursive left hemisphere, and maybe this is more pronounced for men than for women, which might explain something. In fact, studies show that it is more pronounced for men than for women. We compartmentalize and dissociate more than women do, at least on average. What we remove when we commit to discursive thought and analysis is the ability to experience pre-reflectionally. What do I mean by that? Most of us have experiences, and when we experience God, I don't think we experience God because we've gone through a long analysis to determine whether God is there. He is immediately within our experience. Later we may go back and analyze and find greater meaning, find less meaning because it was some kind of a delusion or something. But at least in the experience, we experienced it as an experience of God. In experiencing symbols, I think we have something of that same sort of immediate experience. And so I think it's a different way of experiencing. And I think that if we turn it into a discursive approach, and we have plenty of discursive approaches to religion, but if we turn our ritual into a discursive approach, I think that we lose a large part of our experience. And maybe it's something women would prefer that men did more often. I don't know.
I think I can answer Catherine's question and leave this other debate for when we stop, if it's okay. Is that okay? No, I think I'd rather, if you don't mind, we're going to lose too much time,
Catherine. Yeah, let Kathleen answer.
So let me respond to your question. I think we can resolve any disagreement if I assure you that I don't think that oral traditions are inferior to literate ones. I think one of the things I love about the church is that it offers me the benefits of both those traditions. If anything, I think I agree with those people who say there's an unnatural gulf between the oral and the literate. I think the temple provides us the a way of learning that sometimes, I think there are strengths in both these traditions. I think they coexist. I don't think one is primary to the other and can be ever left behind. I think that now the question we're facing is what cyberspace. I don't know what Joseph would have done with that. But I think that, I'm disagreeing with what you're saying there. I'm not saying that one kind of knowledge is superior to another.
There was an here and then here and then here.
One of the things that concerns me in your campaign's paper, what I'm going to talk about, yeah.
So the question is concerning a type of an agency and consent through the temple ceremony as well as the larger implications of it?
I suppose where I would take your question, and it's going to deserve a longer treatment, I'll be able to give it here. What I'm going to are questions of meaning, not choice. Now, choices arise out of understanding, right? They can't arise out of a vacuum. We make our choices out of what we understand. What I'm suggesting is that the temple gives us eventually tremendous freedom of choice, but I really didn't address that. Because of the multivalence, because it is symbolic, from the moment you step in there, it's all symbolic behavior. People are interpreting right and left. Now, I have no doubt that certainly we're all sitting there thinking we're understanding what it means, but then you hear people constantly say, oh, I sat there all those years, and then I learned this was true. I mean, there are meanings are being exchanged constantly in that atmosphere, and they're not spoken. And you're not going to hear at general conference. It's difficult to be specific because people have different sensibilities about what you can share about the temple. But for instance, something that is widely known is white clothing. People make assumptions about what that white clothing means. But I think it's susceptible to a couple of interpretations of meaning. But I'm not going to hear in general conference that I have to understand it to mean this one thing. And neither is my bishop going to ask me what it means. And what he's going to ask me is about my behavior, not my sense of meaning about the temple. He's going to ask me about certain codes of social behavior, but he's not going to ask me, do I agree with him on what the white clothing means, or in the myriads of other things that go on there in those 2 hours. So that I am free with to come to an understanding. I'm working with those symbols to build my own little house of comprehension about the cosmology. Now, that doesn't mean somebody else isn't going to give a talk about the eternal family that's going to feel like this to me when I hear it. But that person isn't going to demand that I understand the temple vis-a-vis that personal doctrine because they're supposed to be quiet about it, and that protects me. I like that. But that's what I mean by the freedom offered in that choice of meaning and having no authoritative voices. Sure.
Okay. There was a gentleman back here, next, and then right here.
After the ritual, the non-discussed, someone was fun enough to give him.
I'll try. I'll give it to you. I think a central reason that the text is not openly available or written or ready to be spoken about is because of a central point that I don't think any of us have at least publicly mentioned here today, and that is that if you believe, as Mormon theology teaches, that every soul is ultimately autonomous, is uncreated in a technical sense, then you have to agree, as suggested by Blake in his paper a few hours ago, that there is some bit of essence in each human being that God is obliged to respect, and that surely extends to the content of our belief. I think Kathleen is dead on the money when she said that when you go for an interview to get to the temple, those questions center on your moral conduct. They do not center on, especially at time of renewal, whether or not you agreed with any particular person's understanding of the content of that ceremony. Look, it is precisely in my mind because God respects our autonomy because he's obliged to do so. and wants us to grow in ways that we can approximate his character one day, ultimately, that there is no hegemonic presentation which is discursive in nature. That is, every person can bring their own perspective, their own understanding, their own level of knowledge and reason to that experience and read it in that sense. For a person who is steeped in quantum mechanics, you can get something out of it. To the person who knows nothing about the writings of Paul Davis or Heisenberg, there is still something adequate to be received from that. I think God speaks to every person in light of their own abilities to understand that particular aspect of the gospel which might be most fully and completely understood by them. And for that reason, I think the absence of a printed text, the absence of a negotiated public debate or discussion about these is precisely because no such single statement, no such understanding can be forthcoming or ought to be forthcoming. That is, it is symbol because we don't suppose that we confuse the symbol with the thing symbolized. We are to bring to it, I think, intentionally, our own understanding, our own perspectives, our own ways of approaching truth and knowledge, so that God may speak to each of us in ways that are uniquely suited to us, not to others.
I think you raise an interesting issue, the conditional nature of this, and I think it is true that these ideals are extravagant ideals and probably ineffable. I think, however, those early saints lived large in the way we talk about today in another social context. They were able to, even such things, I think of Daniel H. Wells trundling off to India to dedicate the land for the gospel. They saw themselves. They had a different identity that enabled them to speak about these things that we now would say are too ideal for us to even touch. And so we talk about other things. It's possible it could be that conditional nature. I think it's a difference in identity, too.
Actually, there was a ritual to identify when you had made it, which I'm not going to talk about in total, but it was a remarkably limited experience for the early saints, and you know what I'm talking about. And if you don't, I'm not going to tell you. But they had ritualized. Because I think that the sacred nature of being there imposes ethical obligations on me not to discuss it. It's like discussing the most passionate moments of my life and my personal life with my wife. I'm not going to do it. And so, but there is a way of ritually identifying when you're there. And most of us are sad because it's been so limited that I'm not aware that in the past decade anybody's really made it.
But Ness is, now I'm going to ask a question. What is being there? I thought this was a ongoing thing that went on forever. So I know what Blake's referring to, but I don't think we should keep in mind that there's some goal that once we get there, that's it. I think we're making a mistake here about what the whole nature of Godhood is, if we say that now we're there. I'm sorry. Yes, you.
Now it's blossoming into a number of things. So I won't say very much. I fundamentally have a problem with the idea that, first, it seems like I am married.
You are married? You don't talk about everything in your personal relationships with others, right? It doesn't mean it couldn't be conveyed or that you couldn't talk about it with your husband, but you're going to very carefully decide who you talk about it with because they may or may not understand what you value most, right? And you're not going to cast pearls before swine, right? You're going to be very careful about making sure that the value and what you value is properly valued by who you share it with, right? That's the only assumption that I'm making. I'm not saying we can't talk about it, or not even that it means that it couldn't be discursive.
Yeah, image that if we talk about things in a public forum, then we're really getting dirty. Yeah.
Well, I don't. If you don't know in your audience,
doesn't happen either, because she's so sacred that if we talk about her, we're going to get her all knocked out and dirty. And I'm just not so sure that talking about things.
I think there's a different reason. We don't know anything about her. That's probably a better reason for not opening your mouth.
Mm-hmm. He's a brave man, isn't he?
We could have a few sessions here. Yes, go ahead.
Well, Jim is a part of my life today. And
So the comment seems to me that there should you should be able to express your own interpretation of the temple without feeling threatened by it, but since it is under the control of an authoritarian church, that is not the case at all. So there is an imposition on one interpretation.
Of their very rigid ideas about gender.
Well, I think it was a very articulate description of a dilemma. And I think your experience was a profound one, and I think one of the parts of this paper that wasn't presented was the question, even though I talk about the ritual as being one which is not given to discursive treatment, I don't discuss the effect of other discursive treatments on the authoritative changes that are made and not discussed. So I think that that's a whole area out there that that can be looked at with some benefit.
Back here.
What happened to you was obviously very personally painful, and it one of the problems that we have is that the ordinances are administered by people and not by God, and sometimes they're going to make mistakes, and maybe a mistake was made in your case. But there is one thing about ritual that isn't negotiable, and that's what the values that are inherent in the ritual may be. And if the ritual, and Kathleen has assumed that certain political structures, certain social structures, and certain values are assumed in the structure of the ritual, and that imposes upon the society that uses the ritual, to a large extent that may well be. And it may be that your personal values are no longer in harmony with the values that are embodied in the ritual. That may be where a conflict arises. It may be that the society at large no longer shares the values that are in the ritual. If the society as a whole is going to abandon the ritual because it doesn't embody what they believe or what they value any longer, then they have to make that choice. But you don't get to change the ritual and the values that it embodies. You can leave it behind. That's how I see it. You have agency in interpretation, but you don't have agency as to what the ritual as it is. So while you may have a good deal of cognitive dissonance and say, gee, that's really uncomfortable for me, so I'm going to come up with an interpretation that is more in line with my own values.
Well,
at some point you're going to say...
No, I'm not.
We've all assumed for a ritual to impose structure... It probably works. It probably works better if one of us speak at a time. I'll listen to you if you'll listen to me. I think that it's inescapable that the ritual is fixed within certain limits, and the people who get to fix the ritual you may disagree with, and apparently that is the case.
I don't think that's fair. That's my comment. That's my comment. I think we need another question.
Yeah.
Well, say
yes,
not
but I call on this gentleman in the back.
Well, there's another aspect that I'm interested in, and that is the
I think it is a group experience. I don't think that we use it as pragmatically as those early saints that approached it. Again, back to this earlier comment, I think what we would call idealism today was very real to them, so they would gather together and ask the Lord to change the weather. Not just to find the pure in heart, wherever they may be. That kind, you know, there was a real concrete coming together as a community in the here and now, asking for tomorrow's bread today. But I think we still go as communities, and I very much believe that we form a community in the temple. I think One of the interesting things that bears examination is how the temple creates a community within a community that is the church. But I think absolutely the LDS temple experience is a communal experience. I don't see a necessary dichotomy between privacy and group experience, but I think what I understand you to be saying is, could we, on a more conscious level, seek to create community out of the temple? On an unconscious ritual level, there is community being created. Is there a way we, as a community, could consciously do that by talking about those communal aspects? That's what I'm asking you. I don't know, except that I see people trying to do this with ward temple nights, with families who try to gather their families to go there, people that try to mark important family events by taking their family to the temple. Just yesterday I was talking with a young man who's recently home from his mission, and he gets all the fellows from his ward who recently returned, and they go there. That's a communal. So there are communities within. I think it's done a lot in the church. I don't know what I would do differently about that.
Well, Kathy, I wonder. I'm sorry.
How unlike you.
You know, that's never happened to me, Lynn, and I talk about it all the time in there. Who did that? Well, you're probably talking too loud.
Yeah,
the ones
that's the problem.
Which surprises us, too. I don't know why that happened to you. It just doesn't happen to me. Talking too loud in there, Lynn. That's the thing.
Now, there was a question here. Yes.
I was in the session just before.
I think for a lot of people it would. Thank you. Is there a question? Or I appreciate that comment.
No,
I think we're out of time. We're out of time, and so those of you who have more questions, I think you're welcome to come up. And since the session is now over, I'd like to make this comment, because it's not an official part of the session anymore. I think we could fill more than a few complete Sunstone symposiums on what we do know about Mother in Heaven.